And joining us on the phone right now is Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He was the former Middle East Bureau Chief of the New York Times, and he's the author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and American Fascists, as well as his latest book, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, co-authored with Leila El Arian. Hello, Chris Hedges.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the time to be with me today. I know that you're extremely busy. I would like to just start out by commenting on an article I just read. I realize you wrote it a while ago. It was December 31st, 2008, but I think it's one of the best articles that I've read on this situation. It's called Israel is Foolishly Breeding the Next Generation of Islamic Militants in Gaza. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of sum up what you were trying to get through with that.
Yeah, I mean, breaking Hamas as an organization, which I think Israel has now largely done, means that there will be no force or group in Gaza that has the ability to maintain order. Gaza will now descend into chaos, a Somalia-type situation. I think the Israelis foolishly think that they can bring back Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader, who was driven from the West Bank after free and fair elections, which put Hamas in power. Then there was an attempted coup d'etat on the part of Fatah, backed by Israel and the United States, that failed. I first went to Gaza in 1988. I've just watched year after year, decade after decade, as Israeli blunder and miscalculation and use of force has radicalized Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but within the West Bank. Hamas was a marginal fringe organization when I first went there. Now, of course, has commands the loyalty of probably most Palestinians in Gaza and a significant number in the West Bank. And what I fear is that the resistance on the part of Hamas fighters and the brutality of the Israelis, they hit, of course, the UN compound today with the massive numbers of civilian dead, which is being relayed. These images are being relayed by Al Jazeera throughout the Arab world. This is really knocking the foundations from under the secular Arab regimes that surround Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. If Israel continues this policy, and I think this is really the end of sort of the long drive going back 51 years to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, to sort of trap them in impoverished ghettos where they survive on, a little better than subsistence level. I think that Israel's playing an extremely dangerous game, and that it could see itself within a few years completely ringed by radical Islamic regimes. That is the game. So, the assault on Gaza is, of course, a war crime under international law, a direct violation of Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, not to mention it's immoral, but it's finally counterproductive to Israel's long-term interests.
I just watched a short film made by Max Blumenthal where he went to a rally on January 11th in support of the assault on Gaza. It took place again in New York City. There was about 10,000 people there, and some prominent Democrats spoke at that rally in support of the war on Gaza. And some of the folks that Max Blumenthal interviewed, he's a Jewish American journalist, we're saying things like, well, we need to go in and we need to just rout them out. We need to stamp them out. We need to wipe them out. And we shouldn't stop until we've got every last one. And that's going to solve it. And then that'll stop the rockets. If you had a chance to sit down and talk reasonably with one of these folks, what would you say to them as an argument of this, this is not the way? And what kind of ideas would you present to them as an alternative to this?
Well, unfortunately, this is part of the intoxication of violence. These people are, let's be frank, they're getting off on this stuff. I'm not blaming Jews or Israelis. Every culture does it, including our own at the inception of the Gulf War. But it's always counterproductive because radical movements survive on the blood of martyrs, and we have been handing them by the truckload to groups like Hamas. I really fear a rise of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has been trying to make inroads within the Palestinian community without much success. And I think just as, you know, I used to hear 20 years ago this kind of blanket condemnation of Yasser Arafat and the PLO, they're just terrorists. You know, they speak of them as sort of vermin that have to be eradicated, to use the same kind of language as if they're sort of pests that must be fumigated out of existence. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize that there are things worse than Hamas. You know, the shutting off that those moderate voices, shutting off those voices that would like to build some kind of accommodation with Israel. And, of course, you know, who could possibly talk about accommodation if you were living, if you were a Palestinian living in Gaza at this point, is the product of unbridled violence. And that is what, that's what's brought about the resurrection of the Taliban in Afghanistan. That's what has built the resistance movement in Iraq. And that's what, you know, will build groups like Hamas and perhaps even more radical than Hamas. So, you know, their response is not a rational response. It's not an intellectual response. It's an emotional response. And, you know, it's unfortunately, violence has a dark allure to many people. And I think, and I saw Max's report, and that was exactly what we are witnessing. There was a kind of perverse thrill that crowd was getting, and a kind of identification, you know, of power, that Israel's power became in some perverted way an extension of their own personal power. That's a sickness. That's what war does, and that's what it's done to them.
Well, what would you say if you know, they came back with, well, there is no reasonable element on the other side, and yes, maybe we're going to end up being ringed by, you know, Islamic fundamentalists now on all sides that want to wipe us out or whatever, but we were already, and the only thing these people understand is physical violence and military action. What kind of alternative would you say to these people is the approach other than what they're supporting now, which is this?
Well, I was in the Middle East when the Oslo Peace Accord was signed, and, you know, I would be in the streets of Amman or even in Morocco and suddenly hear Hebrew spoken by tourists. There was, under Yitzhak Rabin and the Oslo Peace Agreement, an opening that unfortunately after Rabin's assassination, we lost. The Israeli leadership with the death of Rabin never had any interest, and I include Ehud Barak in this, in establishing any kind of a viable peace. What the Palestinians want is a viable state. And if Israel was willing to honor international law, to withdraw behind the 1967 demarcation lines known as the Green Line, and turn over Gaza, the West Bank, and of course East Jerusalem, I think that they could very well build. And part of the most important element of the Oslo Peace Agreement was not only $5 billion in international aid that never finally materialized, but also a plan to integrate Palestinians into the Israeli economy, to give them a stake in Israel. And that goes a long way to breaking conflicts, just as it did in Northern Ireland when the Catholics were brought up to the economic level of the Protestants. You know, once you have hope, once Ahmed can buy a refrigerator and send his children to school, and you blunt the allure of radical movements when the only way left to affirm yourself in Gaza, if you're a young man, is to be a shaheed or a martyr. And remember, these people, they can't have work, they can't travel outside of Gaza, they can't get married because they don't have any money, they're sleeping ten to a floor, they're suffering, we know, terrible bouts of depression and that when you open up other routes of affirmation, that's how you blunt radical movements. When you close those routes, that's how you empower radical movements.
But is that not the fault of Hamas that things are so miserable in Gaza?
No, Israel has been squeezing Gaza with a vice-like grip since the first Gulf War. You know, the expansion of Jewish settlements, especially on the West Bank, well, exclusively on the West Bank, has been immense, gobbling up, I think, by the time the estimates, the UN estimates are, by the time Israel is done with its expansion of settlements and its use of the so-called security barrier, which dips deep inside the West Bank, seizing, by the way, most of the aquifers in the West Bank, they'll have gobbled up some 40% of the West Bank. This is the largest land grab since the 1967 war. So, you know, there's been constant pressure. And I think that, you know, for those of us who've been in Gaza, there's a very clear understanding of the violence of the occupation. And what that daily indignity, humiliation, and repression does to people who are caged little better than rats, you know, completely surrounded. You know, I think anybody who spends even a few days in Gaza, which, you know, is one sort of vast garbage dump of poverty, and comes away absolutely appalled at what Israel has done.
Chris, I just have a couple more questions for you. You're talking about how there's been this, and you mentioned it again in the article, Israel is foolishly breeding the next generation of Islamic militants in Gaza, which people can find at alternet.org, about how Israel, the Israeli government, is gobbling up these vast tracts of land in the West Bank. And yet at the same time, we keep turning back to the two-state solution as the answer. But there are observers, and I know you've heard this commentary for sure, that say, you know, we've passed the point of no return with the possibility of a two-state solution, because Israel has built so many settlements, taken so much land, they're constructing this wall now, and they've, as you said, taken so many of the aquifers and the agricultural land and everything. Where would a viable Palestinian state develop? If the Palestinians get a state, it's probably going to be kind of like apartheid. I mean, these little non-contiguous cantons and this and that, and divided up by all kinds of Jewish-only roads, which is the present situation. But, you know, they'll call it a state, you know, but will it really be a state? So what's the hope?
Well, I'm afraid I have to agree with you, and I write a weekly column for Robert Scheer's website, Truthdig, and the latest column was The Language of Death, which makes precisely that point, that the language that Israel is now speaking to the Palestinians is exclusively the language of death, and it's all the Palestinians will be allowed to speak back. The way I read what's happening in Gaza is that it's not just about breaking Hamas. It's about, as in the West Bank, creating pod-like ghettos completely ringed by the Israeli military, where at the flick of the switch, they can turn off the flow of goods, food, medicine, you know, movement, reducing Palestinians to utter misery and completely controlled. I think that's what we're going to see out of Gaza. And you're right, that is not only makes a two-state solution impossible, but ensures that down the road, Israel will confront regionally far more implacable foes than they face now. However corrupt and dysfunctional the Arab regimes ringing Israel are, and they are, Hosni Mubarak's Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, you know, these countries ruled by militant Islamists is, I think, the end result of what Israel is doing. And really, at that point, you have to wonder whether, you know, the Zionist experiment in the Middle East will survive.
Final question, Chris. So much of this is funded by American tax dollars, and not only that, by, you know, with the weapons and the money, but also the diplomatic protection that our government gives, the diplomatic cover our government gives to this, and our media, frankly, also, it seems. What can American citizens that are concerned about this, that are very upset, that are frustrated about this, do besides turn out for vigils and other things that people, should be doing, surely writing letters to the editor, you know, this and that? Do you have suggestions for people out there that feel strongly and want to make a change, especially our government's policy?
I was just at a rally, you know, protesting the massacres in Gaza with Vanessa Redgrave and Cynthia McKinney and Adam Shapiro and a few others. I certainly think that's important. I think we have to begin to push for divestment. You know, I feel very strongly about the continued blind support for Israel, given what it's doing to the Palestinians. And so, therefore, I did not vote for either of the two mainstream candidates. I voted for Ralph Nader. And I think that we have to develop a new kind of militancy. You know, if you act like a doormat, you're going to be treated like a doormat. And, you know, when I listened to Barack Obama get up and read in front of AIPAC, a statement we now know was written by Dennis Ross, who will be a Middle East envoy for the Obama administration, a former employee of AIPAC, I can't go there. I mean, that suffering is not an abstraction for me. And I think that, you know, we have to draw the line. We have to say, just as the Israeli lobby does, you know, and that's why there were only five members of the entire Congress who did not vote for this absolutely blood-curdling resolution, devoid of any compassion for the plight of the Palestinians that sailed through the Senate and the House. And I think just as AIPAC will punish politicians who don't toe the Israeli line, we who care about the plight of the oppressed, not only in Palestine but in other parts of the world, have to also develop our own militancy and be willing to punish those politicians who don't stand up for international law and human rights.
But what specifically should we be asking them to do differently?
Well, I think that both McKinney and Nader had it. You know, they were calling for a suspension of military aid to Israel. You know, we give $3 billion a year to Israel. Under the agreements that allows them to receive this assistance, they are not allowed to use this money to prosecute the control or repression or war against Palestinians, and yet they do, just as they have $10 billion in bailout money that they're not supposed to use to build settlements on the West Bank, but they do. I mean, they're in clear violation of congressional agreements on aid and assistance, and of course, nobody stands up to them. And I think that we who care about those who are being abused in our name, it's the least we can do. It's a very small price to pay, given what people are paying in the Middle East. I think we have to step out of the two-party duopoly. I'm just frantic over the bailout, which is the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, and does nothing to help the working class, people being pushed from their homes, 8 million people foreclosed. It's criminal. It's theft. I just, you know, read today, Citibank took all this money, and they just use it to cover toxic assets. Everything they're throwing at us isn't helping. And, you know, unfortunately, we who represent, I think, a more progressive agenda have been willing to play the game with the Democratic Party, and I think that's got to stop.
Thank you so much for being with me today, Chris, and I wish you well.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.
You take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. I want to let you know we were just speaking with Chris Hedges, and he has his latest article is The Language of Death, and it's at truthdig.com. He has some other articles at alternet.org that are very good. I encourage you to check those out. And again, Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior fellow at the Nation Institute, and was the former Middle East bureau chief of the New York Times and the author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascist, and his latest book, co-authored with Leila El Arian, called Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. And, again, his articles at truthdig.com and alternet.org. The latest one is called The Language of Death, that was just posted January 12th at Truthdig.com.